Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Part of me was just like, no, I'm not going to let him win without, you know, some serious competition.
How first-time legislative candidates have approached their campaigns. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 7th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, an Anchorage pastor encourages his congregation to vote.
African Americans, we have to speak, and part of our voice speaking is our vote.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Sneezing, aching, sweating, and coughing. Who has the time for this misery? You have the power to protect yourself and your community. Boost your defenses this season by getting the flu vaccine. Protect yourself and family. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Polls will be open across Alaska and the nation in the 2022 general election tomorrow. But with more people than ever voting early and absentee, it's unlikely that Alaskans will know who they'll be sending to Juneau and Washington for a few days at least. KCAW's Catherine Rose reports.
It took just over 2 weeks after the August 16th special election for Mary Peltola to be certified as Alaska's newest representative in Congress. During those 2 weeks, over 26,000 early and absentee votes were counted, and then the ranked choice ballot process cemented Peltola's victory. Tuesday's results could shake out similarly. Early votes cast through the Thursday before Election Day will be counted on election night after 8 p.m., but it won't be until 2 weeks after the election, on the 23rd, when the final count of regional absentee ballots will commence and ranked choice votes are tabulated. The November 8th ballot looks very similar to August's primary ballot, with 4 candidates remaining in each statewide race. Republican U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski is hoping to retake her seat, vying for it alongside Republican Kelly Shabaka, Democrat Patricia Chesbro, and Independent Buzz Kelly. Representative Peltola is competing for a full term against former Republican Governor Sarah Palin, Republican Nick Begich, and Libertarian Chris Bayh. And for Alaska's governor's race, incumbent Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy is running against former Governor Bill Walker, an independent, Democrat Les Guerra, and Republican Charlie Pierce. In addition to giving the thumbs up or down to superior court judges in each district, voters will also weigh in on whether or not there should be a constitutional convention, a question put out to Alaskans every decade. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
Candidates for state legislature are making their final push to convince voters to head to the polls and rank them first on the ballot. This year, dozens of first-time candidates are showing up alongside returning and incumbent politicians. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George spoke to 3 first-time Alaska House candidates about how it's been going on the campaign trail.
As the sun sets over Turnagain Arm, Caroline Storm is trudging through unshoveled snow to knock doors in a middle-class South Anchorage neighborhood tucked between 2 highways.
Hello!
Hi!
Are you Peggy by any chance?
Yes, I am.
Peggy, my name's Caroline Storm. I'm running for State House. I'm going door-to-door visiting voters.
Oh, okay.
Storm is a Democrat running in a 3-way race for State House in a part of Anchorage called Bayshore Clatt.
Now, is this the first time you're running?
It is the first time I'm running, but
I've been... And this area?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
For first-time candidates, there's a lot of introducing yourself to people who have never heard of you. A lot of trying to embed your name and ideas in people's minds in hopes that they remember you when they vote. It's a huge time commitment, usually on top of a day job. And then there's the challenge of scraping together donors without the large team or campaign machinery of a more established politician. Storm, a Democrat in an area that narrowly went for Trump in 2020, says she's had some voters write her off for her party and had to parse through conspiracy theories about election rigging or COVID-19 vaccines with others. But for the most part, she says, she's been able to find common ground with everyone. Peggy Baker, who answered the door this afternoon, says she's concerned about education and the cost of living.
No, we need to get the inflation under control. I mean, yeah. It used to be a year ago I could go spend $200 and get lots of groceries. Now yeah. I'm lucky if I get one cart full.
Yeah, no, it's a bit out of
control. And being on retirement and Social Security, that hurts.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. I know it.
Because Storm's district is new this year due to redistricting, there's no incumbent to compete with, but her Republican opponent Craig Johnson previously held a House seat for 9 years, starting in 2007. Storm, who's framed her campaign around making sure public schools are adequately funded, says she didn't want to let Johnson claim another 2-year term.
Part of me was just like, no, I'm not going to let him win without, you know, some serious competition.
And primary numbers indicate Storm and Johnson are in a close race. Storm isn't completely new to politics. She worked as an aide for Representative Andy Josephson and has been involved with Great Alaska Schools, a nonpartisan public education advocacy group. Other candidates are much newer to the scene. Benjamin Vincent is a property manager running as a Republican for a district that includes Kodiak, Seward, and Cordova. He says putting his name on the map as a first-time candidate has been a challenge, especially since his opponent is longtime Republican representative and Speaker of the House, Louise Stutes.
I don't have a voting record like some other people do. Some individuals want experience. And yeah, those are difficult hurdles to get over. But I have a willingness to come to your face and tell you what I'm going to do. And I think that speaks volumes, even compared to having a voting record.
Vincent grew up in a military family in Chugiak. They lived outside and overseas for much of his childhood, but he returned to Alaska to attend UAA and moved to Kodiak last year. He says he and his wife put down roots on the island quickly, which has helped with those conversations about his limited experience. Vincent came away from the primary with about a third of the vote. He's running because he disagrees with some of Stutes' choices as a leader, but he says there's a benefit to running even if he doesn't win.
A lot of individuals that I've spoken to, and I have this belief too, it's like competition builds a better candidate.
For Will Stapp, running for office is about continuing a life of public service.
I kind of believe that, if you're part of a community, that you should try to give back. But main reason I do that is because I love Fairbanks. And the reason I love Fairbanks is because Fairbanks loved me when I was a young kid.
Stapp is a Republican running in a 3-way race for the House district that includes East Fairbanks and Fort Wainwright. He served 2 combat tours in Iraq and now works in insurance and volunteers with the Rotary Club. There are no incumbents in Stapp's race either. He came in first in the primary with almost half the vote, followed by a Democrat and another Republican. Stapp is running on a platform to reduce inflation and utility rates through fiscal discipline and responsibility. He says as a first-time politician, he's not guaranteeing any overnight fixes, but he is committed to reducing the level of division in Alaska politics.
So I tell folks in Fairbanks, especially given our unique challenges and our isolation, if we can't be a model of how to kind of interact with each other, even when we have political disagreements, what hope does the rest of the country have?
Stapp, Vincent, and Storm will appear on ballots tomorrow, along with dozens of other new and veteran legislative candidates. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
Anchorage schools will be closed on Election Day tomorrow, with students working from home because of a request from the Alaska Division of Elections. Gail Finumiai, director of the Elections Division, said the request was not related to security concerns. Elections officials in other states have received violent threats from supporters of former President Donald Trump, but Finumiai and Lieutenant Governor Kevin Meyer said those threats have not been received here. Instead, Finumiai said the closures are meant to ensure there's adequate space for voting. Lieutenant Governor Kevin Meyer's office recommended the closures following the 2020 election in order to reduce COVID risk for students. 54 polling stations are at schools in Alaska's largest city, and schools in Juneau and Fairbanks will remain open. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a little bird born in Alaska recently flew all the way to Tasmania.
So this bird was like 4 months old. It's crazy.
It's an amazing bird. It's coming up. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547.
A lot of pastors took time this Sunday to encourage voters to do their duty this Tuesday, which is a tradition at a predominantly African-American church in downtown Anchorage. KNBA's Rhonda McBride went to Shiloh Baptist Church's Sunday service, where parishioners consider the right to vote almost sacred.
The music is always spirited at Shiloh Baptist, and so is the preaching.
And listen, if you don't do it today, if you don't do it tomorrow, you better make sure you do it on Tuesday.
On Sunday, Pastor Andre Parker wove voting into his sermon and told parishioners that if they don't vote, they can't complain.
Did you vote for anybody? No, I ain't vote. Well, shut your mouth. My vote don't count. Shut your mouth. They not gonna hear me. Shut your mouth. Listen, you got to get up, get out, and vote. Why? Because the Spirit of the Lord has spoken.
Pastor Parker says about 70 to 80% of his congregation votes. People like Michelle Williams.
I've been a voter ever since I turned 18. My mother and my aunt and my grandmother, they marched in Ohio.
They also registered people to vote, as well as made inroads into fighting discrimination in Cincinnati.
You may be that one vote that may tip something over. You may be that one vote that will make things happen. So I believe in voting. My grandkids, they used to go around knock on people's doors with me here in Anchorage. 18, my daughter and my son made sure that their kids were down there when they turned 18 and got their voter's registration card.
African Americans, we have to speak, and part of our voice speaking is our vote.
Pastor Parker says stories from older parishioners never fail to inspire him.
I didn't have an opportunity to go through a lot of the civil rights movements like some of them did. And coming out of that era, they too are now encouraging us in my age and younger to say, hey, go vote because it really is important.
It's very important because of the racist stuff, that January 6th incident that happened.
Ruth McConnell says voters need to send a message that they can't be frightened away from the polls. She says Black voters must prove once again that they can and do make a difference.
You hear, well, Blacks not going to vote. They're not going to get out to vote. But having a Black president in my time was a joy.
We all are one people, and we need to vote.
Gregory Wellington says that regardless of race or party, voting should be the one thing that brings us all together, just like the voting machine, completely colorblind.
The machine don't know that you Black. It don't know if you white. It don't know nothing. But all it knows is your vote, and that's it.
And that, for many here, is the beauty of voting, that it's the vote that counts regardless of the race or creed of the person who cast the ballot. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
The mother of a teenager who died of a drug overdose in Fairbanks this summer believes her daughter was murdered. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, police are still investigating the death of Malia Peter, but say, so far, there's no indication drugs were forced on the young woman.
Arlene Peter says she and her family visited Fairbanks from Fort Yukon this past June and stayed at the Sophie Station Hotel. Peter says her 19-year-old daughter, Malia, left their room on the morning of June 5th to take a walk and was found that afternoon yelling for help in the parking lot of a nearby old Kmart building.
Something happened to my daughter here in Fairbanks within those two and a half hours.
Peter says Malia died later that day at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. She says a state medical examiner ruled the cause of her daughter's death undetermined, but found drugs in her system, including a high level of methamphetamine.
When she called, she interviewed us too, and she asked if my daughter was a shooter. And I told her no.
Peter believes Malia was forcibly injected with a lethal dose of meth by another person. She points to bruises on Malia's face, back, chest, arms, and legs.
Bruises all over her body, like she was being held down.
Peter has done her own investigating and says she forwarded a name to police of a person others told her held Malia down and injected her with meth.
She's given us a lot of names. It's not just one name. She's given us quite a few, and the family has given us quite a few.
Fairbanks Police Deputy Chief Richard Sweet says despite conducting a lot of interviews, police have been unable to substantiate what happened to Malia Peter.
Inconclusive to show that she was ever held down, strapped down, forcibly injected. It's just we don't have anything that proves that case or that theory.
As far as the bruises Malia had, Sweet says it's not clear they were from an assault.
They're not specifically handprints. They're not ligature marks. There's nothing along that line. They can also be accounted for because of some of her medical condition and a lot of the life-saving techniques that were performed at the hospital or by EMS.
Sweet points to other unresolved aspects of the case, like how Malia became separated from a backpack she had when she left the hotel.
There was a backpack and an ID, and then I think a cell phone. And then there was something with the family talked about, the clothes that she was wearing were not what she left with. And so that's part of the interview process and going through and saying, well, what can we find? You know, is there any evidence that, you know, where she went, what she was doing, and who she was with between the time that she left the family and then the time that she was found.
Sweet notes that recently obtained surveillance video from a U-Haul center next door to the parking lot where Malia was found could provide some new information. Meanwhile, Malia's mom, Arlene, also continues to look for answers.
I'm not stopping. People are still reaching out to me and giving me information. And I just been forwarding it to the detective.
Anyone with information about Malia Peter, like where she went or who she was with prior to her death on June 5th, 2022, is asked to contact Fairbanks Police. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 45 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at AlyeskaPipeline.com. Voting in the general election? Here are key deadlines you need to know. First, in-person voting begins on October 24th. Want to vote absentee? You must request your ballot by October 29th. Last is Election Day. You must vote or submit your ballot by November 8th. Visit elections.alaska.gov to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Elections.
Trappers will have 31 days to harvest wolves on Prince of Wales Island starting on November 15th. The decision follows intense public criticism hurled at the state's Department of Fish and Game last week. Trappers delivered hours of testimony in support of a longer season and accused the department of mismanaging the island's predator population. KRBD's Reagan Miller has more.
It's freaking insanity. 100% insanity.
Nobody wants the wolves to disappear, but they need to be managed.
With the Fish and Game and the Forest Service, it just seems like anymore they've been kind of infiltrated by a lot of pro-predator people. And they're starting to make decisions based more on emotion than biology.
Prince of Wales Island trappers gave a tongue-lashing to Fish and Game over the preliminary announcement of a 31-day trapping season. Tom Shoemaker is Fish and Game's regional supervisor for the game unit that includes Prince of Wales Island.
So if we assume that this year will be an average year, that would result in harvest of about 80 wolves. However, it could be as few as 65, or it could be as many as nearly 100. And we're comfortable with something within that range. We think that'll be sustainable and provide a lot of opportunity.
The department wants to keep the island's wolf population somewhere between 150 and 200 animals. Based on data from last fall, Fish and Game thinks there's more than 260 on the island. That's lower than the 2020 estimate of 386 and the 2019 estimate of 316. Trapper Daniel Peters was tuned into the meeting. He says 31 days is just too short to keep the population under control.
We could actually fix this if we just keep on them, but we need a little bit more time. We have to have at least 2 months, I think, to really get after it.
Peters pointed to the department's population estimate for the island. He says that should translate to a longer season.
You guys spelled it out and said we'd have a full season if we had over 200 wolves. We do, and we don't have a full season.
Other trappers spoke about a declining deer population. Howard Walcott says he sees more wolves than deer while out setting his traps. He says that's a bad sign.
Everybody's saying it. I'm just going to say it the nice way is we have too many wolves. It's plain and simple.
Kurt Whitehead also says he thinks the population is out of control.
It's shocking the number of wolves that we've seen and heard and the lack of deer. So I'm speaking for a whole bunch of local residents that our subsistence needs are not being met.
Others, like Sam Sawyer, accuse the department of caring more about environmental groups advocating for wolf protections than about listening to locals.
We are the only goddamn state that promotes predator population instead of freaking controlling them.
In Sawyer's eyes, problems with the deer population are tied to the wolves. Sawyer asked Schumacher if deer or wolves are more important.
Both are important, and we're trying our best to manage so we can balance the two.
In Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
A bird born in Alaska this past summer recently flew to the other side of the planet. That's a distance of nearly 8,500 miles. It's called a bar-tailed godwit, and the closest thing it has to a name is B6. That's what it says on a tag on its leg anyway, and it's the tag that allowed researchers to track the little shorebird's 11-day flight from the Seward Peninsula in Alaska all the way to Tasmania, the island state of Australia. The epic journey also captured the attention of both casual and hardcore bird enthusiasts around the world. But before it was internationally famous, B6 was just another godwit chick in Alaska, where wildlife biologist Dan Ruthroff with the U.S. Geological Survey found it. And Ruthroff says, for the humans, finding it to put a tag on it was the hardest part.
The idea was that we'd follow these chicks until they were big enough to put a big fancy transmitter on them, and then we'd wave goodbye to them and, you know, watch all these chicks fly to New Zealand. And in practice, they just walked a lot further than we could, and we could not keep up with them. And so we were super lucky. We did deploy these fancy tags on B6 and two broodmates, two siblings. The problem was those birds trapped their radios because we put these tags on very loosely because these chicks were still growing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wasn't sure if like when the migration starts, if you're tracking multiple birds and B6 just happened to be the one that made it that far, but it sounds like that was the one to track, right?
It was the only one, and we were very thankful that we even had one, you know, after we retreated from knowing, like, well, that didn't work so well. We were happy to have this one bird. We thought, this will be great. We'll track it to New Zealand. But it really surprised us and went much, much further than New Zealand. So sometimes, you know, a sample size of one can provide some of the most amazing insights. So this was definitely not something we expected, a bird going that far.
Yeah, I mean, maybe even indicates that it's not that uncommon, right, for them to fly that far.
Yeah, I think that's a funny human perception we have, that why would these birds fly nonstop over the Pacific Ocean? That seems very dangerous, and it would be crazy for you or I to try this, right? And so we can't even conceive of what an overwater nonstop flight is like. To humans, it seems very dangerous, but to these birds, I think it's reliable that, you know, the Aleutian low sets up every fall. They take off on a big low pressure system. They get a huge tailwind. I mean, it's a long flight, and they're, you know, some of the only animals that do this. It's, you know, the longest nonstop bird migration in the world, but the population's stable. They're doing well. They seem to be able to support this. And so that this bird went to Tasmania speaks volumes about their capacity. I'm sure this bird may look for a shorter stop the next time it does its migration. You know, ideally, you want to expend as little energy as possible, and this bird went as pretty much as far as you can possibly go.
I mean, I just had to laugh when you said that, because it's like, if the headline is an Alaska bird flew to Tasmania, that seems ridiculous, right? I mean, it just seems
crazy. Totally ridiculous. Yeah. And, you know, my predecessors at U.S. Geological Survey, they documented this migration back in 2005, they tracked a bird that did this, and it never fails to amaze people because it just seems so improbable. So, and especially you can sort of anticipate
the wonder of a juvenile bird. So this bird was like 4 months old. It's crazy. It had hatched on the Seward Peninsula in early July, and it had to grow into an adult size and put on, you know, 50% fat so it could fuel this migration. So it's doing just amazing, incomprehensible things in its first 4 months of life, and tops it off by flying to Tasmania.
Yeah. Well, and you can't really overstate that either, right? Because, I mean, we've heard about godwits before. I have, and flying this amazing distance from, yep, you know, Alaska to the Southern Hemisphere, but they're adults. Like, presumably they've done it at least once, right?
Yeah.
But this bird was just born last season,
yep,
and then migration season came. My understanding is the adults take off earlier, right, to give the chicks more time. So it's not like they're flying with them, showing them the way.
That's correct.
How in the world does that work? How do they do that?
Honestly, we have no idea. You know, I mean, I wish I could give you a better answer, but you're exactly right that the adults tend to precede the juveniles. That just based on observations from New Zealand and Eastern Australia, the adults start to, and, you know, I've spent plenty of time on the Kuskokwim Delta in the fall. The birds start to leave in late August. Those are the adults. Pretty soon, it's only juveniles that remain in Alaska, and soon they disappear as well. And like this bird left quite a bit later than we thought. It departed the Yukon Delta on October 13th, and we were starting to get worried. We thought this bird's not going to fly, and it just shows you how little we know. But yeah, we learned a lot from this one bird.
And I guess part of this too is that, as far as we know, the bar-tailed godwits that breed in Alaska are doing pretty well, right? But godwits in other places are not. And that I understand that's part of why you're looking at them.
Yeah, that's the ultimate motivation for this, is that shorebirds in North America, there's been really steep documented declines over the last 50 years. And 50 years is a long time. It's long enough that humans might not even perceive it unless they had somebody collecting data in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, you know, looking at these stopover sites and how many birds are coming through. So there's really solid information that these populations have declined, and yet it's hard for us to perceive that. But our colleagues in Australia and New Zealand have done really good monitoring of the bar-tailed godwits during our winter, which is the summer in New Zealand, and the population counts tend to fluctuate. And they were maybe higher 25 years ago by 20,000 birds or so, but they've been pretty stable at about 125,000 bar-tailed godwits for the last, oh, say 5 to 7 years. That's great. Some of the other subspecies of bar-tailed godwits are declining precipitously. There are bar-tailed godwits that live in Western Australia that breed in Siberia. Their populations are declining very rapidly. So exactly what you said, we're trying to better understand why one godwit population is stable while others are declining.
That was USGS wildlife biologist Dan Ruthroff.
Well, everybody's heard about the bird.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Catherine Rose in Sitka, Kavitha George and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Dave Emmert. Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.